Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope, and I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by our public health correspondent down under, Niall Conroy. Niall, thanks a million for joining us again on Reboot.
Very welcome. Delighted to be here.
So Niall Conroy is a public Irish consultant in public health medicine working in Queensland, Australia. He's speaking in a personal capacity today. And just a reminder to our listeners, thank you very much to those who are patrons, who are supporters of Reboot Republic and the Tortoise Shack. And if you aren't, please, if you could become a supporter, sign up to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Give whatever you can each month. You can sign up and get all the podcasts across the feeds. Get them first. And yes, if you like what you're hearing and you want to help us keep going, please support us so we don't have to get nasty sponsorship. So thank you very much. Now, Niall, in terms of where we are at, we're in Ireland, you're in Australia. We're in two very different COVID universes. You just actually had an outbreak in Queensland there in the last week, and you would have been involved in responding to that. I heard your holiday was even broken up as a result. But listen, maybe you could set out just a bit what happened and how you responded. Not you personally, but what the response was.
I know. Yeah, it's probably an interesting sort of a small case study, because Queensland has a population, about 5 million, so the same as Ireland. And you know, we've not had COVID for quite a while. We get these occasional outbreaks, usually because absolutely everyone goes into hotel quarantine here. So you do end up, whatever you do, Australia has had about 250,000 people come through the hotel quarantine system, and probably, 2,000 of those people have had COVID. So, you're going to get leaks just through breaches in infection control, which is just human nature. And that seems to be what happened here, about 2 weeks ago. So we've not had any COVID. So basically, we ended up with a sort of a leak out of the hotel quarantine system that resulted in about 20 people being infected with COVID. And to us, that was a massive outbreak. Like, I haven't had a day off. I worked all over the Easter break, had to cancel a holiday. Like, this was, to us, an outbreak of 20 people. This was just a major emergency. And while that sounds daft, it's actually, it's a reflection on the fact that we don't have COVID, and how life here is without COVID, and how life in other places is with lots of COVID, and how much we are desperate to keep COVID free as long as possible. And to that extent, the way we do it is, if we get a case, we absolutely hammer down on it. So the way we would work a case, and the way we did work a case like that, is you get somebody with COVID, and you hunt down everywhere they've been, you hunt down everyone they've been with, and you quarantine them, and you isolate them, and you chase down all their contacts. And you're doing things like, you'd interview somebody with COVID and find out, right, where have you been in the last 2 weeks? And they'll tell you everywhere they've been, or where have you been since you were contagious, rather. And they'll tell you everywhere they've been, and you will literally, you have these QR readers where you can track people down. You can track people down by their financial transactions to see were they in the same cafe or restaurant. And you're just hunting people down and say, right, you were near this person. We're going to, and we legally would put them into quarantine. And so basically it's a sort of we build a ring of steel around the COVID patient, and we just find everyone they've been in any kind of contact with, and we put them into quarantine. And the whole point is, when they inevitably have transmitted that to somebody, those people get sick when they're in quarantine, and they're not a danger to anyone else, and they don't spread it to anybody else. So that's what we did. It's the way we've been doing things from the start. And it looks like now, in a period of 2 weeks, I mean, you can never really count your chickens, but it certainly looks at the moment like we've got on top of it. We found what we think are all the cases, and we've linked them back to other people. So we're relatively confident that we haven't sort of missed any links in the chain. But you just never know. But it is an absolutely intense process of just hunting people down and putting them into quarantine. And we do that on a legal basis. So let's say you were in the same coffee shop as somebody who had COVID.
Yeah.
And you probably signed in using one of these mobile phone apps, a QR tracker. But if you haven't, we'd find out from your credit card transaction or CCTV or something like that. And we would we'd find you and we would issue you a legal notice to quarantine at home for 14 days. I think a lot of people overseas think that's heavy handed. It's not something, I mean, as a public health doctor, it's not something I've ever done in my career. And I managed a lot of outbreaks, you know. We generally speaking in the world of public health medicine are not that keen on using the law to pursue public health objectives. But every so often, a once in a sort of career situation like this crops up, and that's just what you have to do. You know, it's about balancing the rights of you to continue to be out in the community after you've been exposed to COVID, and you might be in the early stages of developing disease and you might be contagious, versus the rights of the rest of the community to live in a sort of a COVID-free world. And that's not, it's not an easy balance of rights and risks, but it's a balance that I think becomes a lot easier. Like this conversation in Ireland will make a lot of people go, oh my God, that's dreadful. Look at the way they've used all these ways to hunt you down. And then they've, you know, mandated you to go into quarantine using a legal order. That will horrify some people. And a lot of Australians would have been the same early on. But actually, once you get to the stage of realizing how well it works, and you know that your perspective on it changes, I think. And I have to say, the vast, vast majority of people in Australia would be very, very supportive of the type of response that we would sort of launch against a case
of COVID. It's incredible to contrast, you know, the situation there, you know, and that response with what is going on right now in Ireland and has gone on as our response. Like, we know, you know, the significant, you know, we had 400 cases yesterday, 400 cases in the country. Do you know what I mean? You know, and we have, you know, that's a daily basis. We're going on, you know, that we know that loads of them are referred to just as community transmission, which means they don't actually know, you know, where they got it from. There's, you know, there's close contacts and different definitions of close contacts, but there's nothing like going after, you know, the people who are, as you say, you know, we're maybe close to them, or we're sitting in a, you know, wherever that was. Obviously, we've no coffee shops open right now, but in terms of, be it in a workplace, for example, be it in a workplace or be it in a school or be it in a, that, you know, that this level of, you know, then quarantining those people, you know, there's a lot of asking, but there's not actually that enforcement of quarantine. And I suppose it comes back to as well, I was struck from the very start of you, what you started saying there, that, you know, a leak from hotel quarantine. You know, we still have a situation where we're debating back and forth about what countries should be added or not added. How many countries are on the list of quarantine for Australia?
Every single country in the world except New Zealand. There's,
and did you have any debates about adding countries on or not adding countries?
No, and it happened really quickly. You know, I think you can almost debate yourself into circles about this stuff, but it needs to happen. And that's the reality of this. You cannot control this virus without hotel quarantine for all incoming arrivals. Doing hotel quarantine doesn't mean you will control the virus if you don't do it right, but you can't control it without mandatory hotel quarantine. And that is an absolute. Now, you can debate yourself in circles about this, but I suppose the difference in Australia was we were ready for a pandemic. We'd done a lot of planning around this. So we didn't need to change the law and, you know, do lots of sort of legal and political wrangling about this. This came in really, really quickly. And initially it was, you know, initially it was just a couple of countries, but very quickly it became everybody who came in had to go into hotel quarantine, end of story. And people are really, really supportive of that over here. You know, and I think there's just this sort of feeling that it's been easy for us because we're an island, but I don't think people realize how much we rely on tourism and overseas workers. Our university sector is heavily tilted towards the sort of the Asian markets. You know, it's been very, very difficult, but no, everybody here has to go into hotel quarantine, and that's it. And that's what works, but it's all that works.
I'm really struck by that, what you just said there, that you can't control the virus without mandatory hotel quarantine, and that's an absolute. Could you just explain that further? Because the reason why I'm laboring it a little bit, and you're kind of looking at me incredulously, is because we're in the midst still of a debate about whether this should be done or not.
Yeah, so it's really simple communicable diseases outbreak stuff, you know. Now it's simple from a communicable diseases perspective. I take the point that it's difficult politically, you know, I'd make no bones about that, you know, but you've got a situation where how it works is the virus comes in, you know, and somebody spreads it to one person or two people, and they spread it to four, you know, and it sort of grows exponentially, and each one of those things is a, you know, a transmission chain. And, you know, one person can lead to 700 cases, you know, or they might only spread it to two or three people. But the point is that each of those chains grows. And the public health units in Ireland, their job is to stop those chains growing. So, you know, if you catch COVID, their job is to stop you spreading it on to somebody else. And that's a lot of work, right? The problem in Ireland is if you get COVID, they'll put a lot of work into stopping you spreading it on to somebody else. But then another person comes into the country on a plane that same day and takes your place. So you can never catch up, you know, because every time you snuff out a chain of transmission, another two or three people come in on the plane and start new chains of transmission. And the only way you could ever get around that is if you were snuffing out chains of transmission in Ireland quicker than they were coming in through the airport. But because you have almost, you've just such a tiny public health unit staff to do this, they haven't got a hope of snuffing out the transmission chains that are already in Ireland at the rate, you know, at a quicker rate than they're coming in. So they come in faster than you can stop them. And so the epidemic grows. And you know, you get this nonsense that international travel in Ireland accounts for point whatever of a percent, which is, you know, I think anyone who clings on to that figure hasn't a notion what they're talking about. The reality is in Ireland is that you don't detect most cases. So by the time, let's say you get it, you could have caught it from somebody who came in from overseas, or you could have been the fifth person down the line who's caught it from someone who's come from overseas, but you won't be regarded as a travel related case.
Yeah.
When the reality is, you know, the virus didn't grow in Ireland. All cases came from overseas. And what you need to do is you need to sort of look at it like you have two sectors. You have the already here on the island, that sector, and you have what's outside the island. And what you need to do is you need to stop what's coming in, and then say, okay, now let's deal with what we have here. Let's snuff out these chains of transmission. Let's find this person who has COVID, stop them transmitting it. Next person, next person, next person, and start shrinking the outbreak that way. But, you know, you can't do that while new cases are coming in. And it's like the old, you know, I think I said it before, it's like if you've got a flood in your bathroom, you know, because a pipe is leaking. It's like just coming in and trying to use the bucket to get rid of all the water when the pipe is still leaking, you know. Yeah. And what they're trying to do in Ireland is they're sort of covering a bit of the leak, you know, with the 33 or 43 countries, whatever it is now, but you still got this massive other leak, you know, and they're just putting a little bit of blue tack over part of it and still using the bucket, same size bucket, you know. It doesn't work. You need to concentrate on the cases that are already in your country and stop new cases coming in. Otherwise, you absolutely cannot get on top of this outbreak. You know, if you're even letting in, like there's been all this talk of, well, if we could just do enough hotel quarantine to get down to, you know, 40, 50 cases a day would be okay. You absolutely will not. You know, 50 cases a day within a few days becomes 100. Then that becomes 200, becomes 400, 800, 1600. People just need to be realistic about the sort of the way this virus spreads and the exponential nature of its spread and how quickly one or two cases becomes an outbreak. And, you know, I think a lot of people might remember, because it made the news a lot, that there was a big outbreak in Melbourne and Victoria and Australia here. It was massive, sort of back just before last summer.
Mm.
And that came from one case, you know. Yeah. There was just one case and it leaked out of hotel quarantine. And next thing, I think there were 700 cases. You know, that's the way this virus is. So basically, it's an unfortunate reality. And people argue about this, you know, as if we can negotiate. But it's an unfortunate reality is either you accept the virus is here, and if it's here, it's going to reproduce in ways that you can't detect, and it's going to cause explosive outbreaks, and you're going to have restrictions and lockdowns and all that, or you get rid of it entirely. There's no living with 30 cases a day or 40 cases a day or 20 cases a day, because your 20 cases a day become 40, become 80, become 160, 320, and so on. There's no static way of living with this thing. There's no homeostasis, you know. Now, that might change when you get significant amounts of people vaccinated. But as things stand right now, you don't live with COVID. COVID doesn't want to live with you. And so you can't force it. You know, there's no living with COVID. You either say it's here and it's the boss and it's going to tell us what we're going to do in terms of lockdowns, hospitalizations, ICU admissions, or we're going to stop it coming in. And it really is as simple as that, you know.
And it is still quite stark. And if you look at, you know, Ireland's case, the, you know, as I said, we're at 400 cases a day still. How do you see it? You know, we have obviously a vaccination rollout going on with the intention that, you know, and hopefully if it does all go well, you know, potentially, you know, it's difficult to put it in a set, but let's say by the midsummer that we will have a significant proportion of our adult population vaccinated or at least having a first dose. You know, what would you see a trajectory of the virus on that basis, or what would you see it going?
To my mind, a vaccination program is about getting the whole population vaccinated. I think I have been involved in vaccination programs for a long time, and it's a core part of public health. And we don't often, I mean, there are some diseases that just don't affect adults particularly, you know, so we concentrate on babies and stuff. But broadly with something like this, you would be thinking you want to see the entire adult population vaccinated before, you know, I would think it's a success. There's been a huge amount of interest in individual cohorts. Like if we get all the elderly and vulnerable vaccinated, we're sorted. Yeah. The problem with that is that people quite rightly identify the fact that young people don't get very sick with COVID by and large.
Mm.
And it might just be one in a few hundred of them would end up in hospital. But the problem is, let's imagine you sort of say, right, you know, we've got all the over 60s or whatever vaccinated and the vulnerable people. Let's open up. Well, the virus will still be in the country. And then within the young population, it will spread like absolute wildfire, because these poor sort of, you know, 20 somethings who, you know, and the rest of us with that age were having a great time, you know, people in their 30s have just been locked up for over a year.
Yeah.
They'll quite rightly just be meeting everyone they can. But basically, the conditions will be there for absolutely uncontrolled spread. And if even sort of one in 500, 600, 700, depending on what age group you're talking about, ends up in ICU or dies, actually, by the time it runs through 1 million or 2 million people in the population, you've got a really significant number of people hospitalized or dead, you know. So my feeling is I'm as desperate for anyone to open up. I would give my right arm to visit Ireland.
Yeah.
You know, I love going home. I haven't been able to get there. I have a new baby, hasn't met his extended family. I would absolutely give my right arm for Ireland to open up and for it to be safe. But for me, really, we're not safe until we're into a stage where pretty much the adult population is vaccinated. And also, I'd want to keep an eye on the new variants. We're not really at a stage yet where the new variants are completely, are making their vaccines completely useless. But we certainly have, we're at a stage where vaccines are less effective against new variants, some pretty spectacularly so. And my worry is that the world is ripe for the spread, the generation first and the spread of new variants, because we had a situation where the COVID outbreak is really almost the definition of inequity and inequality. You've got this world where high-income countries have essentially bought enough vaccine to mostly vaccinate five times their population. Then you have the opposite of that, where you have low-income countries and some middle-income countries who are completely dependent on vaccines being given to, because they could never in a million years afford to buy vaccines for the entire population. And those countries are not getting vaccine. There's a sort of a group called COVAX, very good sort of international group of sort of, I think it's associated with Gavi and, you know, the Gates Foundation and people like that who are getting, doing their best to get sort of vaccines out to low-income countries. But their aim by the end of this year is to have 20% of people in low-income countries vaccinated. And even at that, they're still about $2 or $3 billion US dollars short of what they need. And that's the primary conduit to which low-income countries will be receiving their vaccines. So the problem with that, right, is that doesn't all seem all that relevant to Ireland. The issue here is the way variants develop is they're spontaneous. The virus doesn't think I'll change. It's a mutation. And sometimes the virus mutates. And that's a really useful mutation. It goes, oh, look, I can infect more people. You know, it gives me an advantage over the others, right? So when those mutations happen, that strain of that virus spreads like crazy. So if you get a variant that gives it an advantage, it will spread. And that's how we get these global variants of concern, like these P1 and these sort of B135 ones, all these ones we all hear about nowadays. Now, every time a virus reproduces, it has the potential to mutate, every single time. And mostly they don't. But the more they reproduce, the more they have the potential to mutate. So what we have is a situation where we're essentially letting the virus just run amok around the world. But in particular, we don't have a plan to stop that happening in low-income countries. So the virus is likely to continue on pretty much unabated in low-income countries for the next 2, 3, even more years. So my concern is, from an Irish perspective, I have very specific concerns for my colleagues in Africa, where I've worked for a lot of my life. But from an Irish perspective, and this is an Irish show, my concern is that you'll all be sitting here vaccinated next November or December or January or February or whatever. And suddenly a variant will come out of the blue because the epidemic is still raging on in, say, some part of sub-Saharan Africa. And the problem with that is in sub-Saharan Africa, like if you take my old colleagues in Sierra Leone, where I've worked for a long time,
they
don't have the technology to detect a variant. They by and large, don't even diagnose COVID. You come in with a respiratory illness and they'll say, well, this is probably COVID because there's a pandemic. Mm. But they generally don't have the test to say what it is. And if they do, they have no way to know that this is a new variant. And what tends to happen in those situations is they'll suddenly get overloaded by, and really the pattern of infection will change. And then the WHO will come in to examine what's going on. And eventually they'll get some samples and send them off to a lab. And a lab will go, all right, this is a new variant. We all need to be concerned. By that stage, in somewhere like Sierra Leone, it's next door in Liberia, it's in Guinea, you know, it's all over the place. So there's no way to contain it at that stage. You know, so the once you let the virus keep going, then you can generate variants. And once that's happening in particularly low-income countries, you don't find them until it's too late. So that's the ideal way for those variants to spread. And that's my concern for Ireland, is that, you know, no matter how successful your vaccination program is, until all of the low-income and the middle-income world is also vaccinated, you can never really rest on your laurels that these new variants aren't gonna, you know, jump up and knacker you, you know, and something like that. Could you imagine the hit to morale if next March somebody said, yeah, sorry guys, these vaccines no longer work, and we're now starting to see new cases that are this new variant. And you know, it would set the whole thing back, and I don't think people would be able for the sort of the restrictions and the lockdowns again. So that's a big concern of mine. It may not happen, but it is very much a possibility. It's not inevitable by any stretch of the imagination, but it is very much a possibility.
And I think it is. It's very important to talk about that those inequalities and both globally and within. You know, countries, and of course, you know, COVID has shone a light on those and highlighted them. But I think that is a really important point and something we need to think about, because I think there's still a lot of short-term thinking about how we're responding to this. And it's a bit of, in a way, from, you know, our own, the Irish perspective is like, as you're kind of setting out that, well, if we get like most even adults vaccinated, or even half of adults vaccinated, it's like literally party. You know, it'll be to our hands up. Yes, we're done. You know, we have people protected. And then suddenly, as you say, you've got the issue of, you know, potential variants because we're not globally vaccinating everybody. But also you have the situation within Ireland again, that potential of younger populations who aren't vaccinated. You know, as you say, the virus spreading like wildfire. So to me, I think they're very important points about thinking beyond 3 months, 4 months to actually a year's time and 2 years' time. And obviously that's very difficult for the population, for us, you know, particular, where we're literally living in lockdown Groundhog Day. So, you know, you try to stop yourself thinking, and, you know, we're thinking to the summer and when we'll actually be able to meet our families, you know, and people around the country. That's all you're thinking to. And I think that there's a real danger then that the politics reflects that. And also, you know, politicians aren't thinking about that in terms of that more medium term. And I think maybe that might be a reason as well why, along with other reasons, which are, I think, anyway, business interests and a reluctance to disturb privilege in terms of putting the mandatory hotel quarantine, you know, that full quarantine in place. So just in terms of that, the question then, you know, that it brings up and something you've talked about is that variance and, you know, the impact of variance on vaccines and obviously as well, you know, not just vaccines, but in terms of, you know, for example, our hotel quarantine system, what implications that would have. But what, you know, what do you know about vaccines and variants, and what do we know about that at the moment?
So it's a broader issue. So the variants can do a number of things. They can affect your vaccines specifically. And we'll go on to that in a second. But the other thing is that they can also make the virus more likely to infect people. So, you know, we know, for example, the, you know, the B117 and the B135s and the P1s, all these kind of viruses that are now household names, that part of their sort of machinery is that they can infect people much more effectively. And it's fascinating to see how all this works. I don't know if people, how much people keep up with this, but there's this, the way this virus works is it has this spike. If you look at it under a microscope, it has this big spike sticking out of it. And when you inhale, when you inhale the virus, you know, someone's coughed or sneezed or whatever, what has to happen is this spike has to find your cells and stick to them, you know? Yeah. And once it's stuck to your cell, it kind of opens up the cell and injects its genetic material in to start reproducing. And the better that spike is at sticking into your cells, the better chance it has of infecting you if you're exposed to it. So a lot of these variants, first of all, make that spike a lot more effective. So that if you were exposed to, say, a small amount of virus, previously not enough of it would have stuck to your sort of respiratory lining, you know, and your immune system could have just got away with it. And, you know, you would have swallowed some of it into your stomach, got rid of it with acid, all these kind of things that happen. Now the spike protein is just so effective that even a small amount of it getting into your system sticks on, infects you. It's ruthless. And then it can make it more effective at infecting people. So you'll get more people who actually have COVID. So your epidemic grows. So, you know, if you have a certain percentage of people who will die of COVID, and next thing your number of people infected is three times bigger than it would have been with the, you know, with the previous variant, well, then you'll have three times the amount of people dying. And then the other thing is that it can evade your immune system and it can evade vaccines, because the vaccines are made to attack this spike.
Yeah.
And if the shape of the spike changes, then the vaccine may not recognize it. And what we're at now is a situation with some of these vaccines where the spike is changing a little bit, and it's making it harder for the vaccine to do its job. Ultimately, your immune system gets there and kills it off, you know, in most people, but a higher percentage of people don't mount an immune system. So we're seeing that with sort of, in particular, the B135 strain is really causing problems in terms of it being resistant to vaccination. But look, to be honest with you, these are all the strains we have now. The B117 and the B135 are strains that the vaccines are a bit less effective against, or look like they're less effective against. Mm. But we haven't got to the stage where we have one that's just rocked in and it's saying, you know, your vaccines are nothing to me.
But that's a potential though.
Yeah, it absolutely is, because, you know, we don't know, we don't know what this virus is capable of. And, you know, you would have to say, and I think anyone who knows anything about viruses and knows anything about communicable disease control knows that the risk, when you have millions of people being infected with a virus, the chance of there being a nasty surprise in there in terms of a mutation or a new variant, it's reasonable. It's very hard to quantify. And it hasn't happened yet in the year that we've had this thing, you know, that it's completely evaded our ability to produce a vaccine against it. But, you know, we go another year and it could well do it. Or, you know, you're in low income countries, you go another 2 or 3 years, it could happen. So I think we just have to be careful. And I would just love us seeing, and it's an absolute pipe dream, but I would love to see a world where we're just thinking about not what percentage of Ireland or Australia or Britain is vaccinated. It really saddens me actually when I see on Twitter or on the news, you know, there are now people posting daily updates of we're now at 4.3% of the population are vaccinated. And I think I actually feel really sad looking at that, because I want to see someone looking at what percentage of the world is vaccinated. You know, we don't even if, you know, and I have such love for Africa. I haven't spent a long time there, but even if you couldn't care less about people in poorer countries, everyone has such a self-interest in us not having this world where we're all in a bubble, vaccinated, looking across the water, and where this virus is running out of control, and hoping that new variants don't crop up that escape her immune system's ability to fight them, or the vaccine's ability to protect against them. So I'd love to see that, but I think that's how we need to look at it. I'm all about looking at vaccination programs as this big thing. I don't tend to think about them as I'm vaccinated or you're vaccinated or my community's vaccinated. It's about as many people as possible getting vaccinated.
No, and I think you're absolutely right, you know, and I think there is a lot of people who both, you know, care about it in terms of a sense of, you know, humanity, common humanity, but also as a point of self-interest, I think both. And I think you're right in terms of we need to think about it, you know, globally, and we need to look at that and how are we actually supporting, how are our governments working, you know, both at the UN, but actually in terms of financially as well, supporting, you know, the global vaccination for low-income countries. And just, I'm interested in terms of that, you know, because some people say, oh, should this be like the, you know, the flu vaccine, and, you know, we'll be able to roll it out annually. And we know, of course, that, you know, vaccines in terms of the flu are slightly changed according to the cycle when they start in Australia and in terms of come back to, you know, Europe and that. Is this different, or how different is it from that?
It's hard to know. Like the amount of variance will change depending on the amount of spread. So if we see, you know, 500,000 people infected every year, we'll see variants cropping up, and we'll probably have to get a booster vaccine every year. And that would be certainly for the next few years. I would anticipate that's what will happen. I would imagine some stage next year, somebody is going to say, right, roll up here for your booster, and your booster will cover you against B.1.1.7, B.1.3.5, and P.1 or something like that. And I know that the labs are actually working on that. So I think boosters against new variants are going to be a reality. But the reality is you're going to have new variants as long as the virus is reproducing at a rate sufficient to generate new variants. I put it this way, if right now, here and now, if literally every single human on the planet was given a jab and in a few weeks' time was given a second one, and none of us had COVID, well, we wouldn't be worrying about variants in a year's time. You know, the amount of variance is dependent on the amount of spread. So I have to say I have a fairly pessimistic view of the world's ability to control this thing uniformly. So I have a fairly pessimistic view of, pessimistic is the wrong word. I think we are going to need boosters. You know, but having said that, the positive thing is that this virus, compared to a lot of other viruses, isn't all that prone to mutations. So it may be that it finds a bit of a steady state in terms of its genetic makeup, but I wouldn't bank on that.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. And it's really, really important insights, Niall. In terms of us getting you back here to work in the Irish health system, which we would love to have you back. But what do we need to do? We know we've an issue with public health and the lack of consultant contracts and resourcing. In terms of your view, do you think about coming back? Or
I do. And it's funny how the longer I've worked abroad a lot, and usually I get home for Christmas at least. And, you know, that gives me my fill of Ireland, and then I can go back. And I'm really, really miss home, you know, because I haven't been there in over a year. It's probably the longest I've ever been away from Ireland. I've worked a lot internationally, but I think there's a couple of things going on. There's a bleakness in my mind about public health medicine in Ireland. So I look at it and I think, you know, people ask me a lot, about hotel quarantine or backwards tracing or this kind of test, antigen testing or whatever, right? And I'm at the stage now where I've started to say to friends, actually, it doesn't matter anymore. Everything is just an effort to do as little as possible to get us through this thing. So, you know, you've got hotel quarantine, which all the hard work was done, legislative, you know, changes, all that stuff, get the hoteliers sorted. And then it was like, no, we'll only do 33 countries. Why don't we bring it down to 5 days quarantine, right? You know, and then you sort of look at sort of walk-in testing. You have to have, to make a dent on this, you have to find cases. You have to have walk-in testing. Just turn up for testing. So I saw they were doing that. And then I see, oh, well, it's just for asymptomatic people. And it's just in towns where we have lots of COVID. Yeah. And every time I see something in Ireland that looks promising, I see it's this half measure. And I have to say, that's the exact opposite of what you would see in the likes of Australia or New Zealand. And it makes me feel, and I know actually this from talking to my colleagues back home, I know that they feel just demoralized. Everything that they need is a half measure. So I suppose that's the first thing. You know, like if I was working on the pandemic in Ireland, I would feel really sort of just, I think, so demoralized that everything that needs to be done, it's almost like people are looking for a way not to do it. You know, pandemics are expensive. And I keep saying this government are trying to exit it with a budget surplus. It's just, they're expensive and you got to do what you got to do. Yeah. And ultimately that helps protect your economy. So I feel a real sadness looking at what's going on at home. And I don't think I'd be all that happy being in the middle of that. And then there's the issue of just what I do for a living. You know, I manage outbreaks. I'm a public health doctor. And I've said before on your show that, you know, we have this bizarre historical sort of strange piece of employment or this group of doctors. This has been tolerated that back in the day when consultant contracts were being divvied out, the group of the public health doctors were mostly women. So it was decided, well, you guys just don't need the same contract as the men. And as a result, they have the same powers within their contract as, you know, someone who works in admin in the HSE. So they can't do their job in any way effectively. And, you know, so I think the mix between being a consultant here and having a full consultant contract and the authority and the autonomy to do what I need to do and having a seat at the table at the highest level, because I'm the one in my region here. I'm the only public health physician in my region here. So I'm the one with the outbreak expertise. Having a seat at that table, having input into it, it makes me feel like I'm doing a good job. And, you know, I think that's important to us all. I feel back in Ireland, it would be difficult to feel you're working to your full potential. And I think over time that probably gets the people. And I know it really gets to my colleagues in Ireland who frequently message me just to rant about just how awful it is to be a public health physician in Ireland at the minute. And I think, so look, got family at home. And I think ultimately someday we'll go back. But I have to say it'd be difficult for the Irish system to match the sort of job satisfaction that you get over here by, you know, where I deal with outbreaks all the time. And we don't just deal with COVID, you know. I think I deal with lots of weird and wonderful stuff that was never in the public eye before. I think a lot of people didn't know public health doctors existed or that we managed outbreaks.
Yeah.
And But I have the authority, the autonomy, I have the team I need, I have the IT systems that I need, I have all the stuff that I need. And I usually come home here at the end of the week thinking I've done a good job and I've kept a bad outbreak out of a prison, do you know that kind of way, or a shelter or a school. Feel like I can do a lot of good for the public here.
Yeah.
Feel like my colleagues in Ireland just feel that they're just working with one hand tied behind their back. So look, it'll ultimately happen. I'm sure I'll come back with the family someday, but I would like to keep the working conditions that I have here in Australia. Yeah.
Well, I think we, as I said, we'd love to have you back. And, you know, I do think that hopefully not just this area of public health will be changed in terms of very, very soon, I hope. And, you know, that from this pandemic that we learn the value of public health and across the board, our health system. And, you know, trying to invest, we need to invest in a resource in it properly. So we have a proper, you know, one tier health system available and accessible with, for, to everybody, and with public health, as you say, at the core of that being resourced properly. Niall Conroy, thanks so much for joining me again on Reboot Republic.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure as always.
And enjoy the heat. We'll get back to our late spring, early summer, 8 degrees outside. but listen, reminder to our listeners, yeah, thanks so much. And if you can become a patron, support us, sign up. And thank you to those who are. You can become a patron, go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack, sign up so we don't have to go get nonsense ads on this platform. And please support us, we're independent media, as I said. patreon.com/tortoiseshack if you can sign up. 5 or 10 or whatever you can each month, and you will get all the podcasts across the platforms first. And that's it. So thank you very much, and we'll talk to you soon.